Welcome to the Teaching Restored podcast, where we help teachers of the restored gospel of Jesus Christ teach better, teach more effectively, be more comfortable, just overall do a better job. I'm Kevin Jones.
I'm Julie Hilliard. And guess what? We have someone exciting with us today. I'm so excited to introduce Matt Godfrey. And Mr. Brother Matthew Godfrey, I guess I should use your full name, is actually a friend of my husband's. And so I have gotten to know him through that, which is not probably what I ought to lead with, because I don't think that that's his most impressive accomplishment. But I mean, come on, Matt, you're proud of that, right?
Oh, you bet. Yeah. Okay. I think that is my most impressive accomplishment.
Okay, we're leading with it. We're leading with it. But Matt is actually the managing historian on the Joseph Smith papers. And he has been working for the church history department for a number of years. And one of the cool things that he does now is that he is, I don't know if you would say leading or concentrating on doing more outreach and education for the church history department, which is so cool. And I've actually, you know, seen some of the benefits of that in our own area, as Matt was able to come out and speak to a group here in the Pacific Northwest. And I know he's talked to our mission, and I know he's done so many other things in that regard. And I think that the importance of having historians who have studied about the history of the church and really tried to understand it better, providing education and the type of transparency that has come through some of these programs is just absolutely incredible and inspiring and so helpful, especially to those of us who are trying to teach some of these more difficult topics. So we're so thrilled to have you with us today, Matt. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk with you both.
Well, we got some good questions for you today. It's going to be awesome. But I think that just to start with, we want to know a little bit about you and what you love to teach. So what would you say is your favorite topic to teach about personally?
Oh, that's a great question. I'll kind of preface that by saying I don't consider myself to be any kind of a great teacher. I enjoy teaching quite a bit. I've taught college classes before. Gospel doctrine is my favorite calling in the church. I love it when I get asked to teach gospel doctrine. So I really do enjoy teaching. It's something that I think just helps me connect better with people. And I've often told people that the main joy that I get out of the work I do is when I'm able to go and speak to wards or to stakes or to church members about the gospel and about church history. When you ask what's my favorite topic to teach about, I think I'd probably have to say Joseph Smith and the Doctrine and Covenants, both of those things. That stems a lot from what I've been doing for the past 13 years of my life, which is essentially delving into Joseph Smith's life, studying all aspects of his life. One of my colleagues likes to say that at the Joseph Smith Papers, it's fun because we get to read Joseph's mail and his journals and all the things that I'm not sure he thought people would ever read, but we get to read those and we get to see what he was truly like. And so I love being able to go out and talk to people about Joseph Smith and about who he was as a person and some of the wonderful attributes about him.
You know, that's a good point. Just real quick, I was thinking, one day there may be a Matthew Godfrey Papers or Julie Hilliard Papers. And if you think about that and everything that we write, we're like, oh, but maybe we don't want them people read. I don't want people reading. So be careful what you write.
If there was ever a Matthew Godfrey Papers, heaven help anyone who has to read those. So.
Are you saying it would be boring? Or are you saying just you wouldn't want to read what you'd find? Mine would be boring.
I will say this. I kept a journal all through like my youth when I was a teenager. I never want anyone reading that journal. It should not be for public consumption. That's all that I will say.
Especially if it had Todd in it. Then
I know, exactly. Right? Yeah. Especially if their experiences with Todd. Todd's my husband, and yes, I can only imagine. I do know you guys, you know, have some pretty crazy stories. But okay, so here's a question. What has surprised you the most as you've studied about the life of Joseph Smith?
Oh, that's a great question. I think I'd have to say that there are aspects of Joseph Smith's life and of his calling as a prophet that I don't think we sometimes think about very much. One of the things that I really enjoyed learning about Joseph, I think when we think of Joseph Smith and we think of the first vision and, you know, section 76 in the Doctrine and Covenants that talks about, you know, the celestial, terrestrial, and telestial kingdoms, we think about the Kirtland Temple where Jesus Christ and other heavenly messengers appear to him. It can kind of seem like he's just always in constant communication with God, that there's just this conduit between Joseph and God, and there's just revelation after revelation pouring down upon Joseph. But I think when you really look at his life, you see that he actually wasn't that different from you and me. Mm-hmm. Yes, he probably had some remarkable spiritual experiences that we won't have in our lifetime, but most of the time, the revelations that he received came to him the same way that they come to us. They came to his heart and to his mind by the Holy Ghost. And I think that's something that we don't really consider very much. I think another aspect of that is God was willing at times to kind of let Joseph struggle a little bit with questions, to try things out, to see what would happen before he would give the light that Joseph needed to move forward. And again, I think that's very similar with how God works with us. He's not always going to give us the answers. And sometimes it takes a long time to get answers. And Joseph was no different. He had moments in his life where he felt like he wasn't getting answers from God. He had moments in his life, like I had mentioned, where he struggled to try to figure out how to move the church forward. And so I've really enjoyed seeing that aspect of what it means to be a prophet and how that may differ a little bit from what my expectations were.
I love that. So something you said in there just kind of gave me a little bit of insight. If God is okay with Joseph Smith struggling on some things and taking time to really learn some of the doctrines and principles and how to apply it and everything, then we should be okay with not only ourselves, but also the people that we teach, our family, those in maybe a class or whatever, that they're struggling, and it's okay that we all need to go through this. Even Joseph Smith went through times of that as well.
Yeah. And it wasn't because he lacked faith. It wasn't because he was a bad person. It was just because that's sometimes how life is. Mm-hmm. And we grow through those moments where we kind of have to struggle and figure things out and kind of move forward. I think it was Harold B. Lee that said, sometimes you have to just take a step into the light before God will show more light for you to move forward into that. And really that is how we grow. And so if we find ourselves in those moments, I know for me, it's easy for me to think, well, maybe it's because I don't have enough faith, or maybe God doesn't love me. And none of those things are true. It's just, this is how we grow spiritually.
Yeah, I love that insight. It kind of brings up two things. And one of them is one of the things that I really wanted to make sure that we got into in this discussion. But really quickly, I just want to make the point that I think a lot of people are really hard on themselves, and that there is this human aspect that starts to shine through in church history when you take a dive that deep into it, like you have with the prophet Joseph specifically. And I think that, you know, considering the fact that there was so much time and space in between some of the revelations that he received, because we write a story in our minds based on the canon that we have, right? And we kind of can read it in quick succession. And so we assume that it happened in quick succession, even if we read the dates and realize that there was this huge amount of time in between them. So that really kind of leads me to this question that you answered when you came out and spoke in our area. And it kind of made my mind go, and that has to do with some of the filters that you need to consider as a historian when you're studying history. So I'm thinking from the perspective of a teacher. Let's say I've been assigned to teach a topic that's related to church history. I'm not a historian. And so I am like filled with, you know, presentism and some of these other kind of filters that can be really scary, damaging, taint my perspective of church history. And you kind of, can you lay out for us a little bit, like as a historian, what are some of the things that you, from the beginning of your education, had to really understand and apply as your filters for studying church history? Does my question make sense?
Yeah, for sure. Okay. So I do have a PhD in history. And so I've done a lot of schooling for that. And as you go through being trained as a historian, you have to take classes. Sometimes they're called something like the historian's craft, which is kind of teaching you how to be a historian, how to think historically, how you approach the past. And there are certain things that you're taught as you go through that those classes that I think are really important and really apply to church history, just like they apply to all aspects of history. One of the things that you're taught is to recognize that everyone has a bias. So your sources that you use, what people wrote in the past, they have a bias to them. Historians that interpret those sources, they have their own biases as well. And me, myself, as a historian, I have my own biases too. These all come from how we were raised, kind of the cultures that we grew up in. They influence how we see the world. And so you're taught as a historian to try to guard against those biases, and at the very least, to be able to recognize what your biases are and to try not to let those biases influence the history that you write. And so it's important, I think, when you're looking at the past and you see, you know, a source where someone's, you know, denouncing Joseph Smith as a prophet or saying he's an imposter, it's important to kind of try to delve a little bit deeper into that, into the person saying this. You know, why are they saying it? What's their motive? What are they trying to do with this information? You know, just kind of those questions around sources that you come across, I think are very important. Another thing, we're often told as historians that the past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. And this is kind of getting into your point about presentism. We're taught to kind of guard against presentism, which is essentially looking at past figures and judging them by your own cultural standards today, which isn't really a fair way of looking at people in the past because they were not raised in those same cultural standards. They did not have the same standards that we do today. And so you have to try to understand people based on their own standards, based on how things were in their time. And that this is the way that you can treat people fairly that you're dealing with in the past by trying to guard against letting your own cultural filters get in the way of what they were doing. So I think those things really are quite important. And I love David McCullough, who, you know, wasn't trained as a historian. He was a journalist, but he wrote many books about history. Talked about how sometimes we don't consider that history is more than just facts, which is how it's often taught. It's more than just the political rulings and reigns of governments, but it's really about people, and it's about people's daily lives. And because history deals with people, and people are very complex and complicated and do things sometimes that we don't understand. I mean, I do things, I think, at times that my wife doesn't understand, you know. Why did you react that way to this? You know, it doesn't make any sense to me. And so kind of recognizing that history really is about human beings, and human beings are messy. And so history can be messy too, and it can be very complex and complicated. And so it's important to try to nuance history. And what I mean by that is not portray it as just black and white, because it's rarely just black and white. There's a lot of gray areas in history, and you have to kind of get comfortable with that, that there are gray areas in it.
You know, in thinking of that, I think of if someone were to write the history of my family, just me and my wife and our kids and maybe my wife's family and my family growing up, the nuances in there and the different angles that you could take from different, who, depending on who wrote what, completely different stories. I mean, it's not even, it won't even be close to the same story. And if we take something like church history and try to nail it and say, this is the way it is, period. And like you said, black or white, that's the way it was. That can be really difficult. So when we talk about the history, but then we talk about doctrine, which is more black and white, this is doctrine and this is God's law. How can we kind of separate those two and understand kind of which to be thinking about at that time?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's something that we struggle with quite a bit. You know, when you're thinking about prophets and modern day prophets, sometimes it's hard to distinguish between, well, what was just their personal opinion and what's church doctrine. And I think sometimes, again, we kind of get in this mindset that anytime a prophet spoke about something, that was doctrine because he's a prophet. So anything he says, that's doctrine. But I think Elder Bednar has talked about some ways that we can approach this that I think are very helpful. And what he has talked about is church doctrine is not just something that one person says, but church doctrine, there are kind of ways that doctrine is determined. And it's determined by, you know, the joint efforts of the First Presidency and the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. So if the Quorum of the 12 and the First Presidency come out with a statement that they've worked on jointly, and they teach that statement, you know, we can be pretty confident that that's church doctrine. If it's just one apostle saying something about something and no other apostles are talking about this, or there's no kind of official statement about it, then that's probably not doctrine. That's probably just a personal opinion of that person. So I think there's kind of safety that we have in the church with councils and with these kinds of things to be able to determine better between, you know, doctrine and opinion and those types of things.
That's great. Thank you.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting because as you're saying this, I'm thinking about a class that I just taught on Tuesday, and we were studying in 2 Nephi chapter 5, where it talks about the skin of blackness, and we were kind of trying to dissect that. And as we were talking about it and some of the possible meanings that, you know, scholars have debated or discussed or maybe, you know, kind of put out there as possibilities, of course, the topic of blacks in the priesthood came up, and there were a few people in my class who had some pretty strong feelings about that, which is understandable. And because we were having the discussion related to what Nephi had written and contrasting that and saying the same prophet wrote, you know, 2 Nephi 26:33, which talks about, you know, all are alike unto God, and kind of the filters that we need to apply about the nature of God to any doctrine that we study about or any church history even that we study about. Like when it comes to, you know, certain difficult things about church history that we maybe that rub us wrong, given our current social understanding and what we believe is appropriate, that it's really difficult to reconcile what we know of God with some of those practices, not policies, not doctrines, but practices even. And so I'm kind of wondering, like, if, you know, because I am not trained as a historian, I'm just, you know, your average teacher. And when something like that comes up in my class, what are some of just the basic, like, how do you respond to things like that? Like when you are teaching a difficult church history topic, and you know that there's going to be a little bit of a rub with people, what are some of the things that are in your mind that you're processing through in terms of how you decide to approach those topics?
Yeah, that's a really good question. When you're dealing with some of these sensitive things, it can be really hard. It can be hard to deal with them. I think race and the priesthood is a good example of this. For me, that's a difficult issue to address, in part because I'm a white male. Mm-hmm. And I've never had to face discrimination or prejudice in my life. So I don't know what that's like. And so it's hard for me sometimes to talk about the experiences of Black Latter-day Saints when that's not my background. You know, that's not my family's background. I can sympathize with them, but I really don't know what it feels like to have had an ancestor who couldn't hold the priesthood or couldn't go through the temple because of the ban on that. And so it's a hard thing to address. I think just being able to recognize that and being able to verbalize that, yes, this is a difficult topic. This is complicated. I think that helps. This, you know, your students kind of know that we're going to be exploring this, but there might not be an easy answer to this. There might not be something when we get to the end of our discussion that you feel super comfortable with. But that's okay, because again, you know, we're talking about history that is messy, and there's not always easy answers for everything. It doesn't matter, or it doesn't mean in those cases where there aren't easy answers that, you know, people in the past like Brigham Young weren't prophets. It doesn't mean that the church isn't true because of these things, but it does mean that we have some messiness and some complexity in our history that we have to deal with. And I think it really is helpful to recognize those types of things, to be forthright about what we know and what we don't know about, you know, challenging issues in church history. Because I think sometimes people think that, you know, we know everything about a topic. Like, we know everything about plural marriage. We know everything about why the priesthood and temple ban was put into place. And in reality, we really don't know a whole lot about either one of those topics. We have to kind of speculate a little bit and try to connect dots where we don't have documents that lay out exactly why something happened. And so again, I think being able to recognize that and to be able to be comfortable with the fact that we may never know, or at least have a very good definitive answer to a question, I think that's helpful when you're dealing with some of these issues.
So I kind of heard three things come out that I just want to reiterate, just because I think that they were really good and they speak to me, because this is, like I said, I mean, I've created a culture in our class where there's nothing that's off limits. Like, I really want people to bring their authentic concerns. We are seekers together. We can wrestle together out loud, but sometimes it's really vulnerable as a teacher to be leading that discussion. And so I heard you say lead with humility.
Yeah.
You know, that I just don't know. And with that humility comes empathy, that, you know, I really can't necessarily say that I know, but I can, you know, say that I recognize there's so much sensitivity around some of these topics and they're messy. And then I really loved that you said the fact that we might not come to an answer, because I think that people sometimes, and I expect of myself, that when people have a question, I'm gonna have an answer because I've been studying something, right? I want that so badly, but it's okay to not have an answer. And we don't have an answer because there might not be one available. And that actually is also okay as well. And then the third thing is that you talked about focusing on what we do know, and then even acknowledging what we don't know. And I think that part of what I heard you say in this is, it reminded me of a phrase that I heard Jared Halverson used in a Book of Mormon podcast, where he talked about, I think it's much more important to have flexible faith than brittle belief. And I just thought that was beautiful. And I kind of hear you saying that same thing, that if we can help lead people into a space where we are acknowledging that our faith needs to be flexible and it might get a little bit messy, but we're all learning and growing as we seek the Spirit in this discussion, then we'll all hopefully feel closer to our Heavenly Father at the end of it versus, you know, kind of creating some, you know, feeding our doubts in a way, which can be so scary. Does that sound like a decent summary of what you were saying?
Yeah, for sure. And I just add to that again that, you know, when you're teaching a class as a teacher, one of the hardest things to do is to say, I don't know. But right. I think being able to say that is so much better than trying to fake your way through an answer when you really don't know the answer. It's much better to say, I don't know. I can do some research and we can come back at a later time and talk more about this once I've looked into this, rather than either dismissing the question or, again, trying to fake your way through it.
And Kevin, I know you're going to ask something, but just really quick, yeah. Like, if you do that and you, what if, I mean, you don't want to give your own answer because that, like, that's almost a little bit scary too. I think that sometimes, like, I've written certain stories that settle things in my heart, but those are the ways that I've interpreted it a little bit. And so we have to be really careful as teachers also that we are teaching, you know, separating a little bit of fact from fiction, so to speak, that we're not, you know, extrapolating our own opinions and beliefs on things and then professing them as though they are church doctrine or something to that effect. So just, I guess, one more caution in there.
Yeah. And I think it's fine. You know, I will often say on some of these challenging issues, I'll say, here's how I've made peace with it.
Yes.
This is how I dealt with it myself. I'm not saying this is how that this is going to bring you peace or this is how you have to look at it. I'm just saying from my own experience, this is kind of how I've come to a peace about this question.
Yes. Yeah. And that feels good to me as well. That's how I've kind of said, this is how I understand it, but please don't take my word for it. Do your own research type of a thing. Sorry.
No, I've seen that happen so many times with people saying this, and I love that. This is how I've dealt with it. Or how I think of it. And I've heard different phrases around that as well. And they can be so very different. I think of a topic my wife recently asked me about. So what do you think about this? And I told her what I think. And I don't know the answer for it. But I said, this is what I'm thinking. And she came back with something completely different. And neither of us are wrong or right, I don't think. It was just the way that framework that we have to put it in so that we can understand it, so that we can make it a building block of faith rather than a building block of fear on the outside. Now, as you were talking, I was thinking about you going through all of these letters, going through all of these documents. And I remember when I was in school, I would read. And sometimes I would come across something and I would think, wow, I want to study that. I want to dive into that. But if I do, then I'm going to let the rest of my studies go and I'm done. I'm going to get an F in this class. If I dive into this really cool topic right here, I've got to kind of drop this and keep going. And I imagine that you probably had similar things like that where you're going along thinking, oh, this is incredible. But I've got to keep reading other documents and I've got to keep doing other things. Were there times like that for you?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, we were on pretty tight deadlines to get the volumes of the Joseph Smith papers out. So you had to be fairly focused on things. But one of the great things about the project was that there were, you know, things that I would come across that I'd say, oh, I'd like to do more research into that, you know, maybe write something about that. And so I kind of make a note of it and put it aside. And then when the volume was done and I had a little more time, then I would go deeper into it and be able to talk a little bit more about that. Can I give just one example of that?
Please.
I was going to ask you for some. Yeah.
Yeah. So one thing that I think is really fascinating, you know, there's controversy about the different accounts of Joseph Smith's first vision, right? You have people who say because Joseph didn't tell the story the exact same way in the four surviving accounts that we have from him, then he was just making it up. He wasn't being truthful. And as I was working on one volume of the Joseph Smith papers, it was Documents Volume 2, which includes his 1832 history, which is the earliest document that we have from him where he talks about the first vision. And there's aspects of this account that differ from the account that we have in the Pearl of Great Price. Most notably that the Pearl of Great Price account very much focuses on Joseph going into the grove and praying to find out which church is true. And the 1832 account is more, it's much more personal. It's more focused on Joseph seeking forgiveness. And he wants to know which church is true because he wants to know how he can best access the atonement of Jesus Christ to receive forgiveness for his sins. And I found it really interesting that he wrote this account around the same time that he had spent 6 weeks, six unplanned weeks, in a small town in Greenville, Indiana. And there's a lot of reason why he was behind or why he was in Greenville at the time. He'd been in Missouri with the Saints there, counseling with them there. And on the way back to Ohio, as he's traveling back, there was an accident with the stagecoach that he was riding in. And Newell K. Whitney, who was with him at the time, broke his leg and couldn't travel back to Kirtland until his leg healed. And so Joseph and Newell had to stay in this small town of Greenville, Indiana, until Newell was sufficiently healed to where he could travel again. And again, Joseph wasn't planning on this, kind of a complete surprise that he had to do this. But he writes a letter to Emma while he's in Greenville, and he talks about how in the town there was a grove of trees. And he used to go into the grove of trees while he was in Greenville, and he would kind of unburden his soul to God about his sins and about wanting to receive forgiveness for his sins. And so he writes this letter on June 6, 1832. We think he composed this 1832 history sometime during that summer of 1832. And I thought to myself, is it a coincidence that he's talking in this letter to Emma about receiving forgiveness of his sins in a grove of trees at the same time that he's writing this account of the first vision and focusing on how he received forgiveness of his sins in a grove of trees back in 1820. Yeah. And I thought, I don't think that's a coincidence. Now, none of this had anything to do with the document that I was working on in terms of making it understandable for other historians, which is what the purpose of the Joseph Smith Papers is. So I kind of put it aside. And then I later did write an article that was published in the Journal of Mormon History about kind of the parallels between what Joseph was telling Emma in this letter and how he described his experience in the Sacred Grove in his 1832 history. And I think, you know, that's one reason why he focuses so much in that history on Jesus Christ and on receiving forgiveness of his sins, because that was on his mind at the time. And I think one thing that we have to remember is when you're recalling something in the past, it's very much influenced by what's happening in your life at that time. You're trying to make sense of what happened in the past based on what's happening at that moment in your life. And so that's just an example of something that I wanted to delve deeper into, but kind of had to wait a little bit before I could do that.
I love that. That's good. Thank you.
I do too. That's awesome. You know, it's interesting because there, when you tell these stories, I feel like a little kid. Like, I feel like I just want to like sit in your family home evenings and I just want you to tell us all of these stories about the things that you're learning. I don't imagine that your kids give you quite the same attention that we would give you. So
I was going to say my kids would gladly trade places with you and not be in my family home evenings. So
I just, so you know, I would be happy to swap with them. If we could teleport, anytime. I would do it in a heartbeat. So I love, one of the things that I love is when you're telling stories about church history, you have these incredible details. I would love, and this is a little bit of a tangent because it's not totally connected to, you know, what we're talking about with teaching, but like, what is your very favorite story that you've studied about? Like, what is one of those just stand out, oh my gosh, I love this story moments for you?
Yeah. Well, I think for me, it really, I'll preface it this way. I'm often asked what's my favorite Joseph Smith document. Mm-hmm. And so kind of my favorite story about Joseph Smith relates to my favorite Joseph Smith document. And okay. So this has to do with Joseph Smith in the aftermath of the Saints' expulsion from Jackson County, Missouri. So you have to remember that, you know, the Saints were commanded to build the city of Zion in Jackson County in July of 1831. They spent a couple of years trying to do that. There's about 1,200 Latter-day Saints that moved into Jackson County to build the city of Zion. But ultimately, in the summer and fall of 1833, there's violent conflicts between them and the other residents in Jackson County, and the Saints are expelled from the county in November of 1833. And I think this is something was really hard for the Saints at the time. They believed God had commanded them to build the city of Zion. They believed they had made a good effort to do so. And I think many of them wondered, why didn't God protect us? Why did he allow these mobs to drive us out of the county? when we were doing what he asked us to do. And Joseph Smith even had these questions himself. And in December of 1833, so about a month after the Saints had been kicked out of Jackson County, Joseph writes a letter to Edward Partridge, who's the bishop of the church in Missouri. Edward has written to Joseph, who's living in Ohio at the time, kind of asking him for direction, you know, what the Saints should do. And as Joseph's writing to Edward, he tells Edward that he has two questions that he's asked God, and God is not giving him an answer. He says that he's asked God why he let the Saints be expelled from Jackson County, and he's asked him, how are they going to get their land back? How will God redeem Zion, is how Joseph puts it. And he says, I've asked these questions, and the Lord's not telling me. The only thing that he tells me is, be still and know that I am God. And so this letter, it's just fascinating to me. Again, it goes back to the earlier point that I made about revelation with prophets. It's fascinating to me that here is Joseph Smith saying, I'm trying to get direction from God, and he is not answering me. He's not giving me an answer. He's just telling me, trust in me, everything will work out. And so this is just a fascinating letter for that. That's why it's, you know, my favorite Joseph Smith document. But the other great thing about this is that a week after Joseph writes this letter, he receives a revelation that's section 101 in the Doctrine and Covenants. And when you read that revelation, you'll see that the first part of the revelation, God tells Joseph why he allowed the Saints to be expelled from Jackson County. So that was Joseph's first question. And then he gives the parable of the nobleman whose land had been overrun by his enemies and who told his servant to call up the strength of his house to go and reclaim his land. And that parable was the genesis for the Zion's Camp expedition, which was the Saints' attempt to try to help those in Missouri regain their land in Jackson County. So that was the answer to Joseph's second question. And so I just love that Joseph doesn't get an answer at first, but that he stays, you know, kind of strong in his faith. He trusts in God, and he does eventually get the answers to those two questions. So I love it because of that. And then I also love it because if Joseph was just making all of this up, why would he write that letter to Edward and say, oh, I'm asking the Lord these questions and he's not answering me? Why wouldn't he just give the answers? You know, if he made up section 101, why wouldn't he just tell Edward that in this letter? And so I love this story too, because I think it really shows that Joseph's not making this stuff up. He's going forward and he's doing the best that he can as a prophet of God to try to get knowledge and direction from the Lord. And sometimes he has to wait for that.
That's great. I think that underscores the point that you said earlier also of, if it's okay as a teacher to say, I don't know. Joseph said, I don't know. He's not answering me. I'm not getting the answer. I don't know. And it's okay for teachers to say, I don't know as well. And be, I don't want to say happy with that. maybe not we're excited that we don't know, but be at least be comfortable in the moment and in front of others to say, I don't know. He put that out there. You know, maybe he didn't realize it was going, everyone was going to see that, but he did put that out to say that at the same time. So that's, I don't know. That's comforting to me. I like that.
Yeah. I also love the backstory of some of these things. You probably, you know, that's probably part of what brings you so much joy. I'm sure love the Doctrine and Covenants in a way that I don't, just because of the way that you understand the backstory to a lot of this. That makes it so much more powerful to me. And I was thinking about, as you were kind of talking about this, you know, there are so many things that we don't know, because we're not studying things the way that you are. I have two questions related to that. The first question is, if you were to just tell teachers, here are some of the resources that you might not think of when it comes to ascertaining information about church history, like where would you point people? And I can tell you that I, for one, have gone to look at the Joseph Smith papers online, and I get a little bit confused, a little bit lost. It's kind of tough for me to navigate, because part of what you're seeing is a copy of the documentation so that you recognize its authenticity. And then I have a little bit of a difficult time searching for things. So just if you could give maybe a teacher, you know, here are a couple of suggestions, that would be question one. And then I'll tell you question two after.
All right. Well, there are some wonderful resources that everyone in the church has access to. It's in the Gospel Library app. If you go into the Gospel Library app and you click on church history, there are several resources that come up there. And a few that I think are especially helpful when dealing with church history and with challenging issues in church history, there's the Gospel Topics essays, which deal with things such as recent priesthood, plural marriage, those kinds of things. There's also another thing called Church History Topics, which you'll see in that same church history menu. And what these are, these are shorter essays that were written to try to explain things that were brought up in Saints. So Saints is the four-volume history of the church that the Church History Department has been producing. Three volumes have been released. The fourth one will be out, I think, hopefully later this year. But there are things that are mentioned in there that, again, because of space and you know, other considerations, the Saints team wasn't able to deal with those issues in full in the volumes. And so there are these kind of mini essays that are written about numerous topics in the church that you can go to and read more about that. It also has like a suggested reading list at the end, another couple of resources that people can look at.
There are a lot so in I think, there. Holy cow, I was just looking at them.
There's looking at it right now. There.
Yeah. And so that's another great resource. And then I also would say, too, that just Saints really is a good resource in and of itself. It's a very accessible history of the church. It's written kind of on a level of kind of a teenage reading level, I think. And it's written more in an engaging way than a lot of academic history is written. But it deals with a lot of the issues that we have in the church. It doesn't shy away from some of the more difficult things. And I think it really is a good resource to kind of explore some of those aspects in a volume that is meant to promote faith, not detract from it.
You know, when I was first reading, I remember coming across things and I'd be like, oh my gosh, I never knew that. Like, I never heard that story. And so I kind of wondered, you know, is this written like fiction? Is that what it's supposed to be? I mean, I feel like an idiot saying that now. And then I realized that this really is very historically accurate. It's well-researched. It's just intended, like you said, to be more accessible in how it's written.
Yeah. And I'll just highlight that every footnote, I mean, everything in Saints is footnoted. You can click on the footnotes in Gospel Library when you're reading it. All of those footnotes have been checked, double-checked, and triple-checked to make sure that the information that is in the paragraphs is accurate, that the source really does say what we are saying that the source says. So you can trust what's in Saints.
That's really, really cool. Neat.
Yeah.
And then can I ask my second question as part of that? And this is a little bit, it's going to feel a little bit like a turn, but it's very connected for me because you were talking about specifically, you know, having access to some of these resources when it comes to difficult church history topics. I want to kind of dig into your heart for just a second. And I know that there are, I'm not afraid to talk about stuff. I'm not afraid of, you know, not having answers. That doesn't really make me uncomfortable because I feel like I have a very strong testimony of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Like the primary questions for me are very settled. They aren't for a lot of people. And for a lot of people, church history is the tripping point. And when I think about that, I have a lot of empathy because things that I come across that don't trip me up, that trip someone else up, I could never, ever, you know, say, well, that's because, you know, make some judgment. That's because of X, Y, and Z in your life and whatever. Like, that's just not ever how I want to think, ever how I want to feel. And so I think really being empathic, that some of these issues that may not trip you up as a teacher could really be sensitive for other people. And so as you are teaching, as you are thinking, I want to get into your mind just a little bit. And this may sound like an awful question, but are there some of those church history topics that you actually find yourself wanting to avoid because you know that they're going to be uncomfortable? Are there some of them that you are extra sensitive because you found through experience that maybe you've botched it when you've gone to teach it and offended people? I learned the most from the times that I botched it, and I'm totally fine talking about it. And so, not to put you on the spot, but I'd love to kind of understand that a little bit better.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I do, we have a group in the church history department that goes out and we do what are called church history conversations. We do this a lot with YSA congregations, but it's not just solely for YSA. But it's essentially where you go and anyone can ask you anything that they want to about church history. And you'll try to give them, yeah, exactly. You'll try to give them an answer to their question. And so when we go out and do those, you know, there are questions that I feel more comfortable answering than other questions, mainly because there are certain topics that I've done more research in. And so I feel more comfortable, you know, talking about those because I feel like I'm on a firmer ground than other things. Because that is something that you have to know about historians. Like, sometimes when people find out I'm a historian, they'll be like, oh, you're a historian. Well, what happened in 1396 in medieval Europe? I'll be like, I have no clue because I don't study medieval Europe. You know, I'm an Americanist. And I even don't know everything about American history, you know, but I am very comfortable on certain aspects of American history and of church history, just because I've studied them more in depth than others. And so there are topics that, you know, when they're raised, I do my best to answer them. Sometimes I don't think I do a great job of answering them. There are others on our team that I think have more strengths in those areas and can give better answers than I can. But I do try to, again, be forthright as much as I can about what I know and what I don't know. And just in terms of botching something, I want to mention something because this actually happened when I came and spoke to your ward, Julie. So this is kind of an example of me botching it, you know.
I don't even know what you're going to talk about. I didn't know you botched it. Okay, let's hear it.
Yeah, so... sometimes when you're talking about some of these challenging things, you don't want to get bogged down in some details. And so there have been a couple times when I've tried to answer a question and I maybe haven't given all of the information that I could have given. And it's not because I'm trying to hide it. It's more just, I think, well, if I start talking about this, then we're going to get off on this track and I don't know how we're going to get it back. And so we were talking about plural marriage at this fireside that I did, and I read a quote from Helen Mar Whitney Kimball, Helen Mar Kimball Whitney, who was the 14-year-old that Joseph was sealed to. And I like reading Helen's, you know, how she described this experience in her life, because I think it's always better to hear it from the person that actually participated in it. But in Helen's account, there is a part in there where she talks about how much her mother struggled when she was sealed to Joseph Smith and how it was a real trial for her mother. And I didn't read that part of the quote when I read this in your fireside. Again, not because I'm trying to hide it, but because I felt like what I did read in the quotation was adequate to kind of convey Helen's feelings about things. Well, someone who heard this presentation then sent me an email and said, why did you leave this out? You know, I'm familiar with this quote and you didn't say this part. You know, why are you hiding this? Mm-hmm. And so I actually had, you know, a fairly good email exchange with this individual about this. And I don't know that this person was ever really satisfied with my answer, but it just kind of made me think again. it's always better to be more forthright than less forthright. And even if you think it's going to derail things and get you off on a track that where you're not answering this, you know, the main question, I think for a lot of people, it's better to do that and be forthright rather than having someone think you're deliberately trying to hide something because you just don't want to talk about it or because it's not a pleasant part of the story.
Sure. Yeah, that's got to be really hard because there's so much that you could say. At what point do you draw the line, though? And right. And you would draw the line in different places with different audiences, given the time constraints, given the knowledge level, maybe given the, you know, whether the spirit is there and prompts you to do one thing or another. It's got to be very different each time. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because we did a podcast about this a while ago where I had my botch it moment. And Kevin, you'll probably remember this, where I was quoting someone and there was a part of the quote that would have brought up some, I guess it was a really bold statement about our doctrine related to homosexuality and gender identity. And I don't, you know, without getting into the whole quote, I took out that part because I just didn't want us to get derailed by a discussion about that, because that wasn't what it was really about. And the spirit actually kind of gave me a little bit, like, I felt bad about it. Like, I felt not good about it. And I'm like, why did I take that out? And I remember reflecting on that before class. And then when I got to class, I actually shared with the class that, you know, I took this thing out. And, you know, this is why I took it out, because I was scared of the discussion and that it might derail us and blah, blah, blah. And we had a really, really great conversation about it, but it did bring up some hard things. And so anyway, we did a podcast about that. And so that's really validating to me that I'm not the only person that has A, done that, but B, it's also validating that transparency and honesty and openness is always, you know, probably going to serve us best. I don't even want to say probably, that's the wrong word. Yeah. I really love that.
Yeah.
Okay. So can I ask just one more question?
I've got a question too.
Okay, so, you go first. You paused. No, I wasn't totally sure. So Kevin,
no. That's okay, Julie. I want to make sure I get this question in real quickly.
You do
okay.
It.
All right. So I think one of the best, I think I have found that for me to be a better teacher, one way to do that is to dive into the scriptures more and to understand the scriptures more. And that's one way that I can become a better teacher. Now, you dove into documents and papers and journals and all of this stuff. What did you learn about studying your scriptures and studying the gospel? What did you learn from all those things that can be applied to studying the scriptures?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, there's a lot you can learn, I think, when you're looking at documents and really taking a deep dive into them. And one of the interesting things, so with the Joseph Smith papers, we do consider Joseph Smith's revelations as part of his documentary record. And so all of the revelations that are in the Doctrine and Covenants that Joseph Smith received, those are included in the Joseph Smith papers. And so we would study those as we were preparing these volumes. But it was always interesting to me to study those revelations as a historian versus as a member of the church, as someone who's trying to get, you know, spiritual insights into those revelations, but just to kind of study them as a historical document. And I think one of the things that I learned from that pertains specifically to the Doctrine and Covenants, again, we sometimes have these preconceptions or these existing notions that scripture comes from the mouth of God through a prophet and it can't ever be changed, or, you know, it has to be something that sounds pristine and sounds godlike and whatever else. But these revelations that are given to Joseph, you know, there's a scripture in Doctrine and Covenants section 1 where it says that the Lord speaks to his servants according to their language. And so when Joseph's receiving these revelations, when he's receiving this inspiration, he's trying to put it into the vocabulary and the language that he knows, right? And he's not, you know, that learned person. He doesn't have a lot of education. And so as he's trying to express these things, sometimes they come out in ways that people don't think sound very divine. In fact, that's the whole reason behind Section 67 in the Doctrine and Covenants, is you had members of the church, when Joseph is going to publish his first volume of Revelations, that question, well, are these really coming from God? Because they don't really sound to me like something God would say. And so this is when Joseph, because this section tells him to do this, the Lord says, well, if they don't think these are divine, then have one of them try to write a revelation. And if they can do it, then yeah, they don't have to think these things are divine. But if they can't do it, then they need to testify that these things come from me, that they don't come from you, Joseph. And so, you know, there's an attempt made and they can't do it. And so then after that, they sign a testimony saying, we know that these revelations come from God. So I think that's just a way of saying that when you read the scriptures, I think you sometimes have to understand that these insights that come to these people that are writing the scriptures, they're expressing them in their language. And so sometimes the insights that they're writing down, the knowledge that they're writing down, can be colored by their own background, by their own culture, by their own experiences. You know, if Laman and Lemuel had written down their record and we had that in the Book of Mormon, how much of their story would be different from the story that Nephi told?
Right.
You know, they would have a different perspective than Nephi has about things. And there's some things, you know, we talk about the Old Testament. We talk about how we don't recognize, you know, Jesus Christ in the Old Testament necessarily, because the God of the Old Testament seems to be very vengeful and just trying to destroy everything and gets angry a lot and whatever else. And I think sometimes, well, so this, you know, the Old Testament record is being written by people from a certain culture, and a culture that was steeped in warfare and other things. And maybe that's how they made sense of God. And so they're writing these things down according to their knowledge and according to their language. And today, you know, when we talk about God, a lot of times we focus more on his mercy and on, you know, his ability to try to help us to become better and to become more like him. Not that he's up there trying to just zap us when we do something wrong, because that's more in tune with our culture as well. So I think it's just important to recognize that there are human factors at play here, that yes, the scriptures are divine. It is inspiration from God, but it's being filtered through human beings. And because of that, there are certain aspects of the scriptures that, you know, when you're looking at them and when you're studying them, there's insights you can gain and things you can get that are based on somebody else's culture or, you know, based on your understanding or whatever else. Anyway, that was probably super confusing, but it's just a way to say that when you're looking at the scriptures, again, it's not so black and white as we might think it is.
That's great. Thank you.
Yeah, that was not confusing at all. Right, Kevin? That was totally agreed. Clear to me. But I did start thinking a little bit about how when kids discover that their parent isn't perfect, that's a little bit like what we're like, sure. Oh, wait, there's a human aspect to all of this in the scriptures. I was like, oh, what? And it can kind of make us go, whoa, for just a second. By the way, I totally cracked up because you were saying section 67 and I'm like, oh no, it's in section 67. So I took it out and I was just kind of reading the heading. And as you're describing it, this actually kind of made me giggle when it's talking about what you suggested. It said, he challenges the wisest person to duplicate the least of his revelations, capital H his. And I was like, it kind of made me crack up just a little bit. Okay. Final question. Is that okay? Kevin, do you have anything else? I'm so sorry. I'm like good. A monopolizer. Yes.
Go for it.
You promise?
Yes.
Okay. Final comments. I would love to know what, just any last thoughts, words of advice, counsel that you would have for teachers when they are tackling difficult church history topics, or any, doesn't even have to be a difficult one, any church history topic. Just if you kind of could put out just a few nuggets, even if you're kind of summarizing some of what you've already said, I would love to hear what you would say to them, to us.
Yeah. Well, I think if you're teaching a class and you have somebody raise a question about one of these challenging issues, it's very easy to get defensive about it. Again, it is for me. I'm not saying it is for everyone, but at least for me, sometimes my kind of automatic go-to is to be defensive about something. And I think as much as we cannot be defensive, it really helps the discussion. It's important to listen to what people are saying, to kind of hear them out, you know, what their real concern is behind the question that, they're asking, where they're at in their knowledge base. You know, have they studied this a great deal and they kind of know much of the background behind the question, or have they just heard something in passing and they're wondering, what the heck is this about? And so being able to listen to people when they ask questions, trying to understand where they're coming from, not getting defensive and, you know, thinking that they're attacking the church or whatever else, but just thinking, you know, this is a legitimate question that they have. So let's delve into it. Let's explore it a little bit. I think those things are all important. I think it's also important to know that we don't need to be afraid of our history. I'll often hear people that'll say things to me like, oh, I'm glad that you study church history because you have the testimony and you can handle it. And I think, well, you don't have to be scared about it. Yeah, there are some challenging aspects to our history. There are things that were done in the past that to us in our 21st century worldview seem really strange and really weird. We don't always have the answers to the questions, but that doesn't mean that we can't explore these things and come to a place where we can feel peace about some of these issues. Because I think there really is some good explanations for things. If we don't know all the answers, at least we can better understand where someone in the past was coming from, maybe why they acted in the way that, they did. And so I think that's important too. And then my final thing will just kind of be something that Elder Anderson said in a talk once where he was talking about Joseph Smith and he said, give Joseph a break. And I love that because if someone is looking back on my life 100 years from now and they're trying to piece together who was Matt Godfrey and they're trying to just do it from the available documents, my guess is they're probably not going to be able to portray a super accurate picture of who I was, what my motivations were, what my desires were, those types of things. And so I think the more charitable we can be to people in the past, the better, because I think we would want people to be charitable to us when they're looking back at our lives as well. And so that's something that I try to keep in mind, and not just pertaining to, you know, Joseph Smith or to our church leaders in the past, but also for other members of the church who fell away from the church. I try to approach them with charity too, to try to really understand, well, what was going on with them? What led them to do this? You know, what was going on in their lives that made them decide that the church wasn't for them and that they couldn't do it anymore? And I think that's a much better way of trying to approach history rather than just thinking the worst of everyone in the past. You know, that everyone had the worst possible motive when they did something. Maybe instead just think, well, maybe they were just doing the best that they could. And maybe they screwed up here, but that didn't mean that they were a bad person. So those are some thoughts that I think I would share about that.
That's so good. Thank you. Thank you. Well, I appreciate you being on our podcast and letting us ask you with a whole bunch of questions and then giving us some really, really good insights. And I'm glad you're friends with Julie too.
Yeah, me too. Me too. That was honestly, Matt, just so wonderful for me, at least, to hear you be able, like, I almost even just as you were talking about this and specifically talking about not getting defensive and some of the counsel that you were giving right there at the end, it really does just, it's such a good reminder to me that, like, this is something beautiful that we have the opportunity to study because our lives are messy too. And it makes it feel a little bit more relatable and it makes it feel just a little bit more authentic when we view these sacred experiences that they've had and still understand that they were human beings. Like, it just, it almost makes it more special. And so I just really appreciate you being willing to share, you know, a little bit of not only your insight, but just kind of your personal feelings about all of this. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on. This has really been a great experience. I appreciate you letting me do it.
Well, thank you. And for those of you listening and watching, if you would please share, subscribe, like, comment, do all that good stuff. We want to help teachers of the gospel of Jesus Christ be more effective. And so anything we can do to help that, that's what we're trying to do overall. So thanks again, Matt. We appreciate you being here, and let's go be great teachers. Take care, everyone. Thank you.
Bye.